the breath is the ideal image of the bond. Because the breath means that there is this unobstructed receiving, like the inhale, and an unobstructed giving, which is the exhale. So spiration, you know, is in fact the image, I think, the best image of love. Love that can be totally open to receiving and totally open to giving. And there's this natural, it has to be both ways. If it's receive, 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 well, you can't breathe. Spiration requires both movements continually.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorc.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, great to be back here with you again.
Yeah, Sharif, great to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, Kevin. Well, we got a great question from one of our members of Optimal Work, and it gets us back to the idea of, well, models and predictions, which we've covered a little bit in the past few episodes, but then this time relating it to bonds and labeling other people. So I'm kind of interested to get your thoughts on this. Can we start with this question?
Yeah, let's start. I'm eager to hear it.
Okay, I'm just going to read it. It's a little bit long, so bear with me. In a conversation with a friend yesterday, it was suggested to me that labels, positive or negative, are not entirely useless within bonds. So this person understood that having prudence in conversations looked a lot like incorporating your memory of how a specific person will react in specific ways of speaking, acting, and attending. So basically, they're saying that having labels of other people helps you to predict their behavior and how they're going to respond, and then helps you, you know, deepen your bond with that person, act better towards them. That's it for reading the question for now. I think we got the key idea. So what do you think of that, Kevin? Maybe that's a good springboard here.
Okay. It's an interesting question about, more generally in a sense, it could be, what are the roles that predictions should play within a bond? And can we use predictions for good? And a label is really a kind of prediction, because you're using something from the past in an attempt to predict how they're going to act in the future. I think that strategies can only really be evaluated from the inside. So when the person is using it, if it's keeping them focused on improving the quality of the relationship, it's probably doing good. So I wouldn't have any. I'd hate to criticize a strategy that's working. So if the person finds it helpful, for instance, it's easier for them to be patient with people if they realize this person's a talker, or this person loves stories, and so this is a storyteller. Well, then, yeah, having that in mind when you're dealing with a person could make you more patient when the story comes. And you're like, oh, there it is. Okay, this is a story. And now you're good. So in your mind, budget 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, depending on the person. And so I think all of that can be a fine, ordinary way of building a bond. The question is that the most common way we improve bonds? And I think that there's a difference between the knowledge we can have of others that can be put into words and a kind of knowledge of them that can't be put into words. Maybe this goes along with the neuroscience distinction between semantic knowledge and implicit knowledge. And so semantic knowledge is held to be a left brain thing and involves labels and words. So then you're using, and in fact, the whole predictive mechanism of the brain is orchestrated in the left hemisphere. So the left hemisphere's goal is to create realistic models of the world around you, and especially the people around you, so that you can navigate those relationships. And that's just the way the left hemisphere is, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. So we have to try using it for good. And that's where the implicit knowledge comes in. There's a sense you can have of people that is so rich you couldn't ever put it into enough words. Where once you've really known someone, you know, it would seem like you could write endlessly about it. So there's something inexhaustible with other people. And I think the right hemisphere is all about this kind of implicit way of knowing others that would be somehow lessened by relying on left brain strategies. So maybe I would say if just getting to know people or in people you aren't really close with, strategies can be helpful. But ultimately, the bond has a life of its own, and it allows you to be much better at tuning in to others, and it doesn't take place through words.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Now, okay, Kevin, I think we might want to dive into this implicit knowledge because it's very interesting. And I think this is the first time you've mentioned it on the OptimWork podcast. So it's something that we'll want to delve into. Before we get to that, let me just dive in a little bit more to the whole labeling thing, because mm-hmm. I know you're very anti-label. I don't know if it's fair to summarize your views that way. But it seems to me that there are kind of different ways you could label someone. Like, you might just label someone's subjective preference. Like, this person mm-hmm. prefers, you know, chocolate ice cream to vanilla. And maybe it's good to remember that as, like, you know, a detail so that you know that, okay, if you happen to be serving them ice cream, you should probably get them chocolate. And so labeling mm-hmm. a person that way, I'm assuming you'd have no problem with that. And then you might label.
Like, it's not really a global label. Yeah, it's.
Right. And then you might label like more of the personality. Okay, this person likes to tell stories or, you know, other elements. Maybe that's a little bit similar. But then at a higher level, more at a deeper level, maybe you get into, okay, this person is, you can get into like their habits. Like, this person is just not punctual, or this person is very disorganized, especially these negative labels, or this person is bad at X, or this person is good at X. And my guess is you're going to have more of a problem with those types of labels as opposed to mere preference or personality labels.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's so easy to put people into a box. So it could be, I think with guys, if a guy says that, oh yeah, that person's an artist, that means something. It means a whole way of thinking and being and a kind of disorder that attends to them. And, you know, what I've also seen among guys, if another guy describes another as an engineer, very often that's a way of kind of writing off the fact that they have any kind of humanities knowledge or insights. And I'm going to say, so it just seems that there's so much mischief that can be done. And like, oh yeah, he's an engineer. Oh yeah. Or so, and even worse, I think, is the DSM. So the DSM, which is only meant originally to be used as a way of doing research on psychiatric disorders. So try to come up with agreed upon definitions of disorders. Okay, that was fine in its day. The danger is once someone has a diagnosis, they get very attached to it. And once someone in their life gets a diagnosis, it seems to explain everything. And so calling someone narcissistic or neuroatypical or on the spectrum, there's just so much it does to limit then our ability to really get to know that person. The DSM has only gotten more and more complex. We're in the DSM-5, and you know it has more diagnoses than DSM-4, way more than DSM-3. DSM-2 had like, I don't know, 20 diagnoses. And I remember someone joking, DSM-1 basically just said, people have problems. It's like, that was the whole thing. Yeah, people have problems. And there's just no way. So the thing has ballooned over time. So particularly like in my practice, as much as I can, do not give any diagnoses. And if I have to for the sake of insurance, it's basically always anxiety unspecified. No matter, I just don't like applying labels. And I've never seen a patient get overly attached to the idea of anxiety unspecified. So that's maybe a long way of answering. So I think it depends on the label. Some labels I just think are entirely bad.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing, this is kind of getting off track here, but is that this is kind of related to like what you use medicine for. Like I know that in your practice, you prefer not using medicine for things like depression and anxiety, but you are okay with it for things like schizophrenia or bipolar, which maybe also goes along with having a diagnosis for that person, having a label. Like it's more just biological and just built into who.
Well, even then, schizophrenia is a diagnosis that takes over 6 months to be of psychotic symptoms in order to give it. To me, that's a kind of failure. We want to get rid of it before they ever get the diagnosis. So the best treatment of schizophrenia is that you are able to help the person as quick in time as possible so that it's like the fever doesn't have a lot of time to burn in the brain and cause damage, which it does. If you let someone stay psychotic for a long time, it does more and more damage. So so even then, it's like you work with someone to prevent the diagnosis. You know, like, yeah, we're going to start this medicine. It's indicated for schizophrenia, but we need you to be on it so you never, in fact, have the diagnosis of it. And that, in fact, can work. So, and that can be a great strategy to prevent the diagnosis. But it has to do, too, with this idea that, so the model is meant to protect us from harm. The model we have of others is to stop us from getting hurt by them or maybe accidentally hurting them. So if you have a label of people like, oh, yeah, they're sensitive about this topic or they're really, well, it's in a way, labels serve a purpose. But almost every time, it is treating people as if they're a problem. So I think that strategies and that kind of semantic knowledge is all great for problems and to break down problems into steps and to learn how to best deal with them. It's not really the best way of dealing with people. So when it comes to people, our dealings with them are ruled by this kind of implicit knowledge that can't be put into words and that lives in the right hemisphere, not the left hemisphere. So it's a kind of know-how. Any skill is a type of implicit knowledge. And ideals, as you live them and develop the habits, that's implicit kind of know-how of how to self-regulate and how to stretch yourself, how to exceed yourself. And then bonds are kind of implicit knowledge of how to be with someone. So the most important thing, I think, is that when we're with people, we are always improving how we are tuning into them deliberately. But trying to, at the same time, use words, to me, seems like a very tough kind of two-step to try to be doing. That if you're trying to like be holding on to words, to me, it's not the kind of unobstructed receiving that we should have in our dealings with others.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine that I think you kind of mentioned this, that one of the reasons why people have these models is, prevent setting off any alarm or causing any problems, avoiding sensitive topics. Okay, I know this person will react poorly if I bring up this topic or raise this issue or whatever it is. So I guess if people take your approach, are they going to just have to be okay with maybe having a little friction in relationships and working through that? And that actually, that challenge of working through friction together leads to a deepening of the bond? Or, so is that an okay kind of warning to give to people or they're just going to have to cause some problems in the course of it?
This kind of reminds me of the issue that happens when you're helping people who worry a lot, is that they attribute their success to the worry, when most likely the success was entirely about how much they cared about people or projects in their life and how dedicated they were to giving their best to these things. The worrying was kind of just something attached to it. It's actually a parasitic process that doesn't really make people better at doing anything. And so worrying is this hyperverbal processing that goes on, you know, that, yeah, it's easy for it to take all the credit. And so they get afraid that, like, if I stop worrying, will I suddenly care less about, yeah, I don't know, being tuned into the people in my life, or in, you know, growing friendships, or being reliable in my job? No. In fact, all of those things are going to be even easier to do. So the worry is a way of trying to predict challenges in advance and solve them in advance that in fact isn't needed. So worrying about how you're going to do in giving a certain presentation doesn't actually help you to give the presentation. Worrying about how you'll do on a test doesn't help you on the test itself to get to do it your best. So I think that most of the time, if people are having good relations with others and they have this habit of, like, I don't know, I guess juggling the labels in their mind at the same time, it just seems like a lot of work to me. And it seems to me like that's taking maybe more credit than it should get. My guess is that the person, the friend, she's just kind of tuned into people already, and she's good at knowing them and knowing what they like. And it shows in this other, you know, habit she has, perhaps, of entertaining labels. But to the extent it's a real label, it's a limitation. It's a limitation on your ability to see anything in the person that goes against the label. So it's always an obstruction to being able to simply receive. And I think that bonds are built by the quality of attending. And that means that we can totally tune in and be with people with, ideally, it's an inner silence.
That reminds me of one thing you said, which actually someone later told me after hearing you say this, they found it very liberating. This was with regard to the inner critic, or holding yourself to high, very high standards, or, you know, kind of being critical of your performance always, that some people think that they succeed because of that, but really they succeed despite that, and that they can just let that go and they'll be more, you know, I mean, in the appropriate way to let go of the inner critic, which we've discussed in previous episodes. So is that the same kind of point you're making here about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. And I think that it's, imagine like you're inhaling through a straw, you know, and that's the obstruction that stops you from being able to receive. Labels are like a straw. They constrict our ability to receive from the other. You know, really, the breath is the ideal image of the bond. Because the breath means that there is this unobstructed receiving, like the inhale, and an unobstructed giving, which is the exhale. So spiration, you know, is in fact the image, I think, the best image of love. Love that can be totally open to receiving and totally open to giving. And there's this natural, it has to be both ways. If it's receive, 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 well, you can't breathe. Spiration requires both movements continually. And so I think that's the way relationships are too. And here I'm not thinking particularly even about receiving the love of the other and then giving love back. I think that is a perfection that makes the bond to be real. But in terms of how bondable you are, it's making sure that your ability to tune in to the other, to receive them, is unobstructed by any kind of preconceived limitations. And then you show forth. Interesting that we only can speak words while we're exhaling, meaning words are meant to be a sign of giving, but the receiving is silent. You can't speak on the inhale. So that you're constantly receiving and then giving. So everything we say to the other should be, in fact, to build the bond. But then the receiving also builds it as we get better and better at tuning into people. And all of that happens in the right hemisphere, and all of that is only hampered by verbal processing.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, Kevin, we've talked a lot about, I mean, I think the way you've framed this, dealing with someone in terms of the way you've labeled them, at least the way I've understood it so far, is that you've emphasized not wanting, you know, avoiding sensitive topics, or not wanting to get them upset or angry about particular things you've broached. But what about giving people kind of positive labels that orient how you actually should treat them, not just things to avoid, but actually things to do. I mean, and we talked about that a little bit earlier in terms of preferences or, hey, if this person, you know, I think this person's a storyteller, so I'm going to encourage them to like tell more stories and talk about their experience and so forth. So is that better or is that still like they're saying, hey, that maybe helps you to deepen the bond with the person?
Yeah. And I think that what you say to people should be informed by what you know of the people. And so, yeah, it's part of how you give to them. You need to be receiving, but you also need to be giving. And on the giving side of it, you want to give them the gift of having remembered them, having remembered what's important to them. The stronger the bond is, the more second nature and easy it is to remember all about them, so that you can recall shared experiences. You can show interest in ongoing concerns you know they have. So I think all of that is really good. I think that, in fact, that happens best when we just are focusing on really caring about people. Nothing makes people remember like caring. So you see these kids who can remember enormous amounts of data about their favorite sports star or their different teams. They care so much about these things. They, in their young way, love them. That they can, the love just fosters the memory, you know? And so there's this incredible link between love and memory. So that, yes, if you really love someone, they are imprinted in you and you can effortlessly recall things about them. So then if you're having a hard time remembering things about people, is it better to come up with strategies to remember or instead to focus on what could be impeding how well you tune into them? So I think that the work that's most necessary is on the inside. It's how able are you to silence yourself and receive, to really authentically tune in, and then to be truly caring as you speak. So to be like, if you could do that and really, I think that, in fact, right brain approaches to strengthening bonds are going to be far more deep and powerful than left brain strategies. But then again, those left brain strategies could be an expression of a greater willingness and commitment to try something, and it can be a place to start.
Okay, Kevin, my next question for you, I think this is all like a great framework for understanding bonds. And I'd like to understand maybe how to think about applying this in a professional context in the workplace. Like, how does this guide maybe our relationships with coworkers, maybe on the same level, or our managers or manager to direct report? Like, how does this all play out, do you think, in a professional context?
I think that it's the same idea of being able to tune into people, but the scope has to change. That in a business setting, I don't think it's right to focus on business relationships as if they are family relationships, as if that you expect the same like totality of the whole person always there. But I think there is something about good professional settings leave people free to have their life on their own, but that you join together here to do something that you all agree is good. And I think that that can be the setting of, if not friendships, at least that there is a kind of professional bond that does develop, where they know that you listen to them, that you understand them, that you're never dismissive of their point of view. The same kind of qualities that help us to bond with others in even like in the more total bonds help us also in dealing with any level. It's like when we do the true success and optimal work, I love that true success exercise. Although success is a little bit of a left brain concept.
That's why it's true success. It's right brain.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. We're trying to make it right brained. And the exercise is very right brained in a way, because you're trying to think of what are the ideals that you think of your most important relationship in your life and think of the ideals, the qualities, the way of being that will help you to give your best in that relationship. And once you've done it with the most important relationship, it applies equally to every other relationship. So usually when you're talking about like the kind of bond you want to have with a spouse, well, to be caring, thoughtful, reliable, okay, loving. They're all species of being loving. But it actually, caring, thoughtful, reliable, that applies to any kind of relationship. It applies to how you are with children, how you are with siblings, how you are with friends, how you are with coworkers. It's just a little different, the context. Whereas if you started that exercise by thinking, you know, how do you want to treat the mailman? And you think of the qualities you want to have towards the mailman, those don't scale up. They're not going to work for how you treat your kids or how you treat your spouse. So you, by starting with the higher level, the bonds, the most important bonds, that allows us then to think of the right ideals that will apply in any situation, including the professional situation. So you always have to start, though, with the most important love, to think of the most important bond, how you want to be in that bond. That then gives you a pattern for the rest of bonds, even professional ones.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, Kevin. Well, so I guess, you know, one topic we haven't really mentioned it explicitly, but I know it's kind of at the core here is, you know, ultimately you think that, you know, we have two possible motivations, love or fear. And that's kind of the sense I'm getting here too, is that, you know, in terms of what drives our relationships with others, it can be love, which is the bond, or it can be fear in some way of, mm-hmm. You know, somehow causing problems in the relationship or something. So I'd wonder if you could just kind of apply that in this case, the fear, love duality to developing bonds with others.
Well, think of it in terms of when a challenge shows up. So that could be in a professional setting or in any kind of relationship. The challenge itself can be the object of fear, and now you're afraid of what it means for the bond or what it means about you, or you know, you think of the deep worries it might trigger. Yeah, and so you could approach challenges fearfully, you know, and that will probably not bring out your best way of engaging the challenge. I think when you could also approach challenges more from the side of how is this challenge an opportunity for us to build the bond and go forward stronger? And if you have that kind of attitude, like how do we use this challenge to build the bond, to somehow make it better? Then the challenges are very good things. We can actually be grateful for the challenge. So it allows us to admit where we haven't, you know, done right. And at the same time, to be grateful for the possible future that we have, you know, that we desire the bond to strengthen, you know, and that now our commitment to improving here is how we're going to show love, really, like how we want to build the bond. So it's the same actually as the breath, to go back to the idea of the breath, but you know, you go from when you have no breath in you at all, that's like seeing how, that's the point of humility and nothingness. That leads to the desire to receive, and that's the inhale, leaving you then full of life at the top. And that's, you're recognizing as a gift, you know, and you're grateful. And then you show that gratitude by actively loving, which is the out breath. So there's, I think that these affections of the heart are just naturally built into how we do the breath. And if you think of that breath, it can be, in fact, a meditation on the most important bonds in your life. And you can think of, while you're being mindful of the breath, which, by the way, is a completely right-brained activity, just to be feeling the breath is totally right-brained, you know, then you can be adding these affections into it, going from the nothingness to the taking in, to gratitude, to loving out. I think it's a beautiful image. And so I think for me, it's always been a helpful one. The most important expertise we can have is not a left-brained strategy. It's knowing how to love. And that's an entirely right-brained reality.
Wonderful, Kevin. Well, I think that is just a perfect, beautiful, poetic note for us to end on here today. So
great. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much, Kevin. All right, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.